I'm John Batchelor. David Grinspoon is the author, most recently, of Earth and Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. David is a planetary scientist as well as an astrobiologist. And David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. And now we have, within these last hours, the exciting news that methanol has been discovered in a gas cloud around Enceladus. Enceladus is the ice-wrapped, cracked, small moon of Saturn that Cassini, the last days of Cassini, lowered its orbit and passed through what is the atmosphere of Enceladus, picking up gas signatures, spectroscopy. And one of the things it discovered was not only did that gas that's venting suggest underground oceans that are cooking off, but that there's methanol in that gas cloud. What does that mean to an astrobiologist, David?
Well, it's exciting because, as we've discussed before, we believe the requirements for life, as we currently understand them, are liquid water and some kind of energy source and organic matter. And what we're basically seeing on Enceladus is a place that seems to have all of those requirements. We've known for a while it has liquid water. I mean, we can see it squirting out into space from these cracks around the south pole of Enceladus, Saturn's little icy moon. Obviously it has some energy source. It's something's in there melting the water and flexing the surface. And now we're understanding that the chemistry of that water reservoir is rich. And it's not just pure water. It's water with interesting other chemicals mixed in, other molecules, including this methanol is an organic molecule. And that, gets our wheels turning as astrobiologists.
David Livingston?
Given that it's an organic molecule, what are the explanations for it other than there might be life there of some sort? Does it have to suggest life or can it suggest something else?
Well, organic matter turns out to be fairly common in the universe. This is one of the things we've learned by exploring the solar system, and not just that, but even in the interstellar medium, the space between the stars, we see this dust that we can determine through spectroscopy is rich with organic matter. So organic matter in and of itself doesn't mean life, but it betrays the kind of chemical environment where life could thrive. So in order to examine organics and actually detect life from them, you'd have to get much more specific and look at the isotopes and the specific mix of organics. And that's the kind of thing we might be able to do with a future mission to Enceladus. But this is a sort of a much more crude assay of the chemistry there. And at least it tells us, hey, the right kinds of stuff are existence there that could provide the basis for some kind of metabolism, but it doesn't really, we can't say that it's betraying the existence of life at this point.
We identify the methanol molecules with a ground-based telescope. We did drive Cassini through the atmosphere of Enceladus and picked up water vapor and perhaps other chemicals that we'll identify in future. I do not jump to any conclusions, David. You've taught me over these decades to hold back, but I recall a conversation that we had when Mars Orbiter Express first went into orbit around Mars. This is more than a decade ago. And at that time, it picked up a signature of methane, that there was the suggestion that it was seasonal, coming off the surface of Mars. We've now had Mars Curiosity, the rover that you participated in one of the experiments on, pick up methane signatures off of the ground level in Gale Crater, asymmetrical signals, perhaps seasonal. Is methane a connection to methanol, or are these separate events? Because that methane signature that was picked up by Mars Orbital Express turned out to be a good indicator of where we were headed.
Well, methane and methanol are not the same thing, but they're both simple organic compounds. Methane is the simplest organic compound there is. It's CH4, a carbon with four hydrogens, and methanol is basically a that same CH3 group, but with an OH attached to it, which makes it technically an alcohol. But it's a very similar compound, and they're both exciting because they could betray the presence of other interesting, maybe even biological chemistry. When we see that methane on Mars, we say, oh, wait a minute, methane shouldn't be on Mars. That in the atmosphere, it's not stable. Something is producing it. And one of the things that produces methane on Earth is methanogenic bacteria, little life forms that breathe out methane. And so when you see methane on Mars, that's at least one of the hypotheses you have to entertain is oases underground of water that are hosting bacteria that are making that methane. We don't know if that's the case, but there's something strange going on with methane on Mars. And so, yes, whenever we see organic chemistry where we don't expect it, we start to try to explain it. And one of our explanations, especially in watery places, is always the possibility of life.
Finally, David Livingston and I have declared today Planet Nine Exists Day. Planet Nine is the never seen, only speculated about large body somewhere in the Kuiper Belt that has an irregular orbit, so much so that it can explain the disturbance of elements of the Kuiper Belt. David Grinspoon, I've just repeated all that I've read. Please explain what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, first of all, Planet Nine, in my view, exists because we went there with New Horizons 2 years ago. But that's, let's not get into semantics here. But yes, there are hints, indirect hints of large undiscovered planets farther out in the solar system in the outer Kuiper Belt. And, you know, these kind of hints, they keep kind of coming and going. And a lot of astronomers, myself included, are skeptical because these kinds of predictions have been made before based on the patterns we see in the orbits of other objects that are most easily explained if there's an unseen, undiscovered object perturbing those orbits of the known objects. And again, you know, people are reporting these patterns as they discover more Kuiper Belt objects. They're orbits seem to be non-random in the way that could betray a large planet. And there's another one of these reports recently of even potentially a Mars-sized planet.
Right. All right. I just want to give David Livingston a chance. David, are you is this Planet Nine Exists Day or Planet Nine doesn't exist for the space show? Just we have a few seconds, David.
I'm skeptical. I would like to know why our instrumentation and stuff is not sensitive enough to pick it up or to find it if it's there.
David Livingston of The Space Show, David Grinspoon of Earth and Human Hands. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. I'm John Batchelor. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show, joins me, and we're very pleased to come to David Grinspoon, an astrobiologist, a man who spends a deal of time talking about planetary sciences, here the second half of the year to summarize some of the mysteries of the first half of the year, and also to talk to David about his new book, and also about things that might happen in future. For example, the world's going to end. It was December 6, 1997. I'm following reporting in the Washington Post. A Space Watch program at the University of Arizona identified an asteroid, 1997 XF-11, as the thing we've waited for these many centuries, the one that's going to end civilization as we know it. A mile in diameter, that's 1.5 kilometers, that's large enough to ruin an afternoon in Paris, plus. The announcement was made that it was not entirely out of the question for this to strike on Asteroid Day, and the date of Asteroid Day that we were all going to have to change our way of living. The dinosaurs wouldn't come back, but they'd be on the road if we left the planet, was June 30th, 2017. That's significant, of course, because it passed, and we're all still here. David Grinspoon, a very good evening to you. The fact that throughout these last 25 to 30 years, frequently there's this trope where an asteroid is discovered, scientists at a remote mountaintop observatory, you know, just like in B movies, every scientist has a daughter who's his assistant, and the ace stunt pilot comes by, and the world's going to end. David, you've seen these movies many times. All right.
Yes.
This happens frequently. Why, David? Are they trying to scare us? Do they think we're not paying attention? What moves them to threaten us with death on June 30th, 2017? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening, John. The thing is, you know, there's good reason to believe, as we've discussed before, that one of these objects sooner or later will strike the Earth again, as they have in the past. And the longer you wait, the larger the object is that has some expectation of striking. There are some monsters out there. And when you first observe an asteroid, you don't get a very good determination of its orbit. You get a very rough approximation with a big range of possible orbits. And so you calculate those, and when you see that among that range of orbits are some that could intersect the Earth in future years, that gets your attention. And you might even say, in good conscience, you shouldn't hold back that information from the world. Although it's tricky, because usually what happens is that then you observe it on successive nights, or you get other astronomers to observe it as well. And when you can observe it over a longer period of time, you can really start to nail down that orbit and predict its future course much more precisely. Or sometimes you can even find archival historical images from other telescopes where they've accidentally caught that same asteroid, and then you can get a very precise determination of the orbit. And then usually you backtrack and say, oh, it's not going to hit the Earth. So those initial prophecies of doom, it wasn't so much that they were necessarily trying to get people to panic as reporting that there was some small but real chance that something that they have observed might hit. And then it gets to an interesting, sort of policy question. At what point should you hold back that information? Should you wait until you know more? Or is it irresponsible to wait if you are if you're the only person on Earth that knows there's some small chance that everything's going to get destroyed in a few years? So it's a little tricky.
Mr. Livingston?
Dr. Grinspoon, why do they always say, maybe we have a chance of deflecting or doing something if we discover it 10 years out? What happens if it's 5 years out or 7 years out or 3 years out? Are we doomed?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that's, there's no magic number of years. But if you think about it, 10 years is a pretty healthy amount of time to build some fancy, sophisticated space hardware and reliably deploy it. You know, think of the Apollo project and how long that took. If we set our minds to something and we have, we have motivation, and we would have strong motivation in that situation, we can, do something pretty bold and reliable and, accomplish things in 10 years. Could we do it in a year? That would be very hard if it was a system that we did not have deployed already. And somewhere in between that 1 year and 10 years is, the longer you go, the more time you have, the better you can imagine that we would be able to reliably do something about that. The more time we have, the better. Now, counter to that is the argument, that's why we should go ahead and build a system and not wait until we've seen something coming. And that's, why people are hoping to do some of these tests and experiment with the technology to do this so that we don't have to start from scratch if we find ourselves in that situation.
Dr. David Grinspoon is the author of Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future, just out. So we're going to shape our planet's future now, because NASA's proposing a double asteroid redirection test, shorthand DART. This is about planetary defense, which at one time was a science fiction term, but is now very much part of NASA's mission, and other space agencies are joining in. David Grinspoon, double asteroid redirection test. It was a discouragement to me that NASA recently canceled its asteroid redirect mission. This looks like a subset of that, DART. What are they proposing to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little bit of a less ambitious plan. They're basically, along the lines of what we were just discussing, the first step in learning to deflect a dangerous object, should we need to do that someday, is to sort of go out and play around with this a little bit and just try pushing some small asteroids around and see if we can do it and if we understand cause and effect, start to learn how this works. And so this is an idea to go to a pretty small asteroid. It's called double asteroid redirection test, DART, because they want to go to a binary where there's a very small asteroid orbiting around a larger one and just sort of give the smaller one a little push and observe how its orbit changes. You know, really as a first step to kind of practice, can we do this? Do we know what we're doing? Does it respond in the way we expect it to respond? You know, so it's really just kind of a baby step to see if we're capable of pushing asteroids around, because someday we'll really be very motivated to want to do that with an asteroid that's got our name written on it.
Dr. Space?
So this test is going to try in 2024, I understand, for Didymus B, if I'm pronouncing that right. How far away is that asteroid from Earth?
I'm not sure, actually, the exact distance, but I believe it is considered it's not an Earth crosser, but it's one that comes relatively close to Earth. So I suspect, therefore, they don't necessarily have to go all the way out to the main belt between Mars and Jupiter to intersect this. But that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure of the distance that they're proposing for this.
What are they going to do, David? Are they going to shoot a bullet at it? They described something called a refrigerator-sized spacecraft. Is this just basically a ramming mission?
Yeah, I think they do basically hit it with a fast moving projectile. Basically with the spacecraft itself, I think basically smashes at high velocity into the asteroid, and then they just want to observe.
Now, I've read some fancy things over the years, Dr. Grinspoon, so have you. There was at one point the theory, and I think it's still advanced, that you don't have to hit an asteroid. It is moving pretty quickly. It's moving 6 to 14 kilometers per second, which is a bad afternoon. What you need to do is change its orbit, or its in some fashion bring up an object next to it and use it like a gravity tug. I've read that. Do they not have patience for a gravity tractor? This seems kind of crude in Hollywood to just slam a missile into it.
Yeah, I agree. It's not the way I envision ideally dealing with a threatening asteroid. But you can argue at least it's something that will help us learn the properties of these asteroids and how they respond to impulses that will change their orbit. The gravity tractor is such an elegant idea that you just put a massive spacecraft up and you put it alongside the orbit of a threatening asteroid, and its gravitational attraction sort of gently pulls it enough to change
right,
its trajectory.
Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to make it miss the keyhole, or at least miss the keyhole enough.
Yeah.
Keyhole is described as a theoretical points in space that if the asteroid, the near-Earth object, the planet killer, passes through it, the likelihood of it striking Earth in future goes up. So what you want to do is miss the keyhole. And I always like the gravity tractor as a way of getting ahead of the story, maybe decades ahead of the story.
It's a really elegant design. I like it, too. I think it would be a harder thing to test in that you need a massive spacecraft to do it.
Right.
And you know, of course, launching a launch mass is the whole game, you know, and it's the reason why, you know, Elon Musk and these people are trying to revolutionize things by making it cheaper to launch stuff off Earth. But the way you would probably build that kind of a massive spacecraft is not to launch it off of Earth, but build it out, ideally out of space-based materials like stuff from another asteroid or stuff from the moon, which is the kind of space-based manufacturing that people are talking about trying to get into later on in the 21st century. We're not quite there yet as far as building massive spacecraft in orbit. But in the meantime, something like this DART mission gives us a chance at least to, start to see what happens when we go out and mess around with asteroid orbits and do they respond in the way that we expect they will.
All right, the world hasn't ended yet, so we're going to go to other mysteries of these last 6 months. Most fresh, the mystery of Enceladus. This is the ice-wrapped moon of Saturn that turns out to very likely have an ocean underneath the ice-cracking wrap. And now we have a discovery of a significant gas discovered in the clouds of Enceladus. Dr. David Grinspoon, the author of Earth in Human Hands, David Livingston. Dr. Space of the Space Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is Hotel Mars. Finally, David Livingston and I have declared today Planet Nine Exists Day. Planet Nine is the never seen, only speculated about large body somewhere in the Kuiper Belt that has an irregular orbit, so much so that it can explain the disturbance of elements of the Kuiper Belt. David Grinspoon, I've just repeated all that I've read. Please explain what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, first of all, Planet Nine, in my view, exists because we went there with New Horizons 2 years ago. But that's, you know, let's not get into semantics here. But yes, there are hints, indirect hints of large undiscovered planets farther out in the solar system in the outer Kuiper Belt. And, you know, these kind of hints, they keep kind of coming and going. And a lot of astronomers, myself included, are skeptical because these kinds of predictions have been made before based on the patterns we see in the orbits of other objects that are most easily explained if there's an unseen, undiscovered object perturbing those orbits of the known objects. And again, you know, people are reporting these patterns as they discover more Kuiper Belt objects. They're orbits seem to be non-random in the way that could betray a large planet. And there's another one of these reports recently of even potentially a Mars-sized planet.
Right. All right. I just want to give David Livingston a chance. David, are you is this Planet Nine Exists Day or Planet Nine Doesn't Exist for the space show? Just we have a few seconds, David.
I'm skeptical. I would like to know why our instrumentation and stuff is not sensitive enough to pick it up or to find it if it's there.
David Livingston of the Space Show, David Grinspoon of Earth and Human Hands. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. I'm John Batchelor.